After Party Pod is brought to you by the book Ending Addiction for Good, which is by Cliffside Treatment Center founder and CEO Richard Tate and Dr. Constance Scharf, Cliffside's addiction researcher. Through self-disclosure, case studies, scientific facts, and firsthand experience, Tate and Scharf explain how anyone can recover from addiction. I'm a big fan of the book. I'm not the only one. It's received rave reviews, and it also made it into the VMA's gift bag, and you just know those people need to hear this message. You can get the book by going to Amazon, or you can go to Cliffside's website, which is cliffsidemalibu.com. Get the book. Get it now. I recommend it. Well, hello there. It's Anna David with After Party Pod. Oh my God, do I have good news for you guys today. I don't even know that there are appropriate words in the English language that have been invented yet that could do justice to John DeVore. He is, that's what I'm saying. I mean, I should just be silent because I don't know that there are words. He is a writer. Right now, he's the managing editor of an Emmy Award-winning website, but he has written many, many things, all of them intelligent. He has written for The Frisky, giving a sort of men's advice column. He has written for Maxim, where he helped launch the website, and he wrote for and edited the magazine and rejected me, as we get into in the interview, when I was trying to write for his section of the magazine. He had a very popular radio show with a woman named Diana Falzone, and it was called DeVore and Diana, and it was on Sirius's Maxim radio channel for years and years and years. And he, most importantly, he's a friend of mine, and he's somebody that I knew back when he was boozing. And as I told him in the interview, he was someone I could always very much tolerate despite the drunkenness, because he's so intelligent and so funny that would show through the drunkenness. And dear God, that is not always true of people. So with that, I am going to introduce you to my delightful guest for this edition of After Party Pod, John DeVore.
I enjoyed the
what did you
Tales
enjoy?
Of Lust.
Oh, you did?
I saw with Sarah at that truly bizarre venue.
Wait, but now we're actually recording, and I know. I mean, it's not that we can't talk about True Tales of Lust and Love. Let's
I was just. I just thought I would start
by with a compliment.
By flattering you, I'm a big fan of your work.
Well, John.
Yes.
Let's talk about how I'm a big fan of your work
you
and
you. Just went
you,
into host voice,
which is why you're sitting here on my
Is that
couch.
Why?
Yeah, I really am. I don't know that you know this, but in a sense, we've known each other a long time.
Yes.
And in fact, we've known each other even longer than you know, because you looked...
Is this going to get weird? Is this going to get... Now I'm interested.
You looked nervous before any of that just happened.
Why?
It's really not interesting at all. It's
let's talk about it.
It's just that when you were living in New York and I was living here in Los Angeles, the better city... I was a successful freelance writer, and I did a piece for Laura Gilbert when she was still at Maxim.
Maxim Magazine,
I believe.
The New Yorker for morons, that's right. So you wrote for Laura. Great editor, fantastic magazine editor.
Fantastic. Yeah. Currently at UFC.
Yes, she Vegas. Lives, yeah, she's in Vegas, and she is working for that hugely successful...
Yeah, so back then she knew how to spot talent, because she was like, you are terrific at this, and then she was said, you're so great. I remember she was really pleased I wrote a head and deck that she used, whatever, who cares, this isn't about me, it's really about you, I think. So she
it remains to be seen, I don't know yet.
Left Maxim, and I really was looking for freelance work, and she said, well, you have got to email John DeVore. He is so funny, and he really gets it, and I think he'll really like you. And so I would say 5-6 emails potentially went unanswered. You didn't know me. You know what I mean? You were just a busy guy.
Very busy, very powerful very editor. Powerful. Very powerful editor.
New York City.
For a magazine with a 3.5 million paid subscription. I was right. a powerful right. douchebag.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
were you actually a douchebag or were you just overworked? Or?
Wow. I didn't know that you had pitched me.
I don't think, yeah. I don't
were
think
the, well, the first done. Question is, were the pitches any good?
I think, I'll tell you that I made a good living for many, many years as a freelancer surviving on my pitches. They seem to work for Details, Cosmo, Red Book, Playboy. Maybe not good enough for Matt.
You know, the short answer could just be the patriarchy. The long answer, I didn't know that you pitched me. Well, here's the thing. It could have been any number of things. Like, I tell freelancers when you're pitching an editor... to, like you did, unsuccessfully, but to pitch multiple times, because you have to assume, and also to spend a lot of time on that subject line, because the success, the email box of an editor is oftentimes just this snowfall of PR emails and work emails and pitches, so it's very easy to get buried. I would also say that during those years at Maxim,
you were drinking quite a bit.
Well, I had this thing called the key to the gear closet.
What?
Well, you know how on like the Devil Wears Prada they had
the clothes,
the fashion closet, where the Stanley Tucci, the gay fairy godmother, would
takes
dress
it in there. Yeah.
Right. I had the bro version of that, the access to the bro version
where
of that.
What was in there?
And the gear closet was thousands and thousands and thousands of dollars of video game consoles, DVDs, Nerf guns, you know, all manner of toys, flat screen TVs,
and
a lot of liquor.
Right.
I would get sent liquor all the time because I'm a men's, you know, one of the very few things that a men's magazine can write about.
Right.
You know, is beer.
Right.
Boobs and bacon. And,
right.
Like, you know, and toys. So we would get, I'd get cold pitches for liquor stories.
So you're saying that you were drinking the liquor, playing a video game, watching a flat screen TV, and throwing a Nerf ball, and that's why you were too busy to respond to my pitches?
Well, I'm sure I'm a terrible person.
There's that, too.
I'm a terrible person. I was drinking, I was living the life.
No, yeah, I just wasn't that important. Is really, I mean, look. If
look,
you want to
any editor who's in charge of a large pile of freelance money gets cornered like this at least once or twice.
Not always on a podcast.
Not always on a podcast. No, not at all. And they always get asked why not my pitch?
Yeah.
And the answer is it got buried. Yeah. Or also it's human nature too. Like no one you would not. You know what? It's decent and professional, and as I matured, I've learned to do this. But it's mature to shoot someone down.
Yes. No. But my theory,
and to be a better editor, I would have engaged a spunky, talented freelancer and told him or her. Is specifically what I needed to be pitched.
Well, the only interesting.
Did you know what I needed?
I think I did. I also was doing a lot of Maxim cover stories at the time.
Well, you did a lot of the sex writing.
I did, but I did a lot of the celebrity interviews too.
You did do that, absolutely. So I did neither of those things. So why were you pitching me in the first place?
Because I think I wanted to dominate Maxim magazine. I was like, I don't know.
You dodged that bullet.
I wrote for them happily for years, and
it was a great gig. It was a lot of fun.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
But it was also another era.
It was
a very Gen X bro sort of like you know, like era.
Yeah. You were right in the middle of that. So but then I would go to New York periodically, and I would do like serious radio shows, and I had the pleasure of doing your radio show, DeVore and Diana.
Yeah, see, we booked you. Nice.
Yeah, I know. But you did. Was that money? I'm after the green stuff, and I don't mean pot.
I gave you a platform.
You did, and how generous of you!
I know.
No, and you were so I so got how funny and smart you were, and that was it. Was such an interesting combination, you and Diana, and that ran for years and years. Correct?
Yeah, it was a lot of fun. You know, Maxim was a strange experience, if only because I came to New York as a playwright. And I, when I got hired at Maxim to launch their website, I was, you know, I was doing a lot of, like, experimental, weird, like, arty sort of stuff so that I would become one of the voices of high-end frat boy America is something that always surprised me.
I didn't know this about you.
Oh, sure. I mean, you know, when I wrote for Maxim, when I would write for Maxim, what I would imagine as a good hack, I'm a hack writer. I would sit down and imagine what my friends in Virginia and Texas would be entertained by.
Right.
You know, there's a reason I moved to New York, and it was to get away from bros and tubing and watching football every Sunday. You know? I wanted to spend my Sundays watching experimental dance pieces at PS122.
Did you do that? Ever?
Oh, absolutely. I'm very part of, when I was in New York, part of the Brooklyn, New York, off Broadway, like experimental theater sort of scene.
That's so interesting. Cause
I mean, that was my passion. That Maxim paid my bills. Yeah. Maxim helped me produce a number of plays that I wrote and produced.
They did?
Well, my paycheck. It was my day job. I would go.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, that's right. You know, and also Maxim probably coughed up a few thousand dollars in Xerox copies of plays and what I used to call the my art tax. Whenever I would work at a company, I would levy on that company what I called the art tax, which was them letting me use their Xerox machine or their conference rooms or whatever.
Right, and possibly some of their time that they were paying you.
Yes, right, absolutely. So by the time, though, we got to Maxim Radio and I was kind of given free rein with Diana and my producer Leah to essentially reinterpret Maxim for broadcast, I made it like a weird sort of expression.
Okay. Okay.
Of dude stuff.
Well, it's interesting though, because I knew that in the last couple of years, I mean, since I lived in New York and left, I knew you had done a play, and my perception was, oh my God, look at John DeVore branching out. I did not understand.
And so I had two worlds, one of which were fruity theater people who drank like fish. As show people do, you know this, because Los Angeles is a show town, and actors and writers drink.
Yeah.
And then, on top of that, I was in an industry of drinkers, journalists, anxiety, deadlines, in a magazine that
celebrated that.
Well, sure, because that is a one of the few expressions that it's a masculine, it's an expression of masculinity to be able to drink a lot.
Well,
and you know, and it's a bonding sort of thing, and it's kind of like the drinking culture is for many men is you know, it's a glue.
Well, also, just so you know, I do feel like the perception out there in those years that we're talking about, let's say that early aughts, was everybody who worked at Maxim was an alcoholic. I mean, that just sort of was what people thought. That's what people would say. They're all drunk.
We would have, well, drunks.
And
in the terminology and in the prejudices of sobriety, that's a big difference.
Huge difference.
I would call myself a drunk. I was a drunk. I was a good one, though.
I know.
At Maxim. I had a wet bar in my fucking desk.
Wow.
All right. Every day at five, and it was a lot. You know, people. You know, I make fun of Maxim, and in that way that you make fun of family.
Right.
You know,
right.
And I, you know, and anybody in media, especially now, who would criticize Maxim, I agree with any criticisms, but my criticisms come from the inside and the fact that I worked on it a lot.
Right.
You know, I launched the magazine. Right. I mean, I launched the website. With friends of mine that I've known for, you know, 12 years now. I was on the magazine side.
Yeah.
I did the radio.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, I played the part. Great.
Yeah.
But no, I'm sorry. I said no.
I feel bad for calling them all alcoholics when really it was just sort of.
No, but many of us were.
And potentially drug addicts.
But look, it's a fine line because we celebrate substance abuse.
Yes.
You know, it's a romantic. Dionysian sort of thing. And it's a fine line between that and then admitting that, you know, alcohol is the world's worst anxiety medicine, that you have a predisposition or, like, you know, or you just cannot drink, you are powerless. It's a fine sort of line.
Well, you know? I think it's really interesting, and my theory, I mean, we as a culture celebrate, like, drinking wine and substances, and I would say that those magazines did veer into celebrating substance abuse.
Oh, absolutely, but you know what, but in that way that rock and roll celebrates.
Yeah.
And in that very adolescent romantic way that we, you know, like, no one looks at Jim Morrison as a cautionary tale. Nobody whispers about Janis Joplin. You know, they're the saints of debauchery. You know, they are, you know, there's just that sort of, like, and it's not just an American thing, it's a timeless sort of thing, you know, to celebrate that kind of revelry, you know.
I mean, less and less, wouldn't you say?
I would say that in terms of recovery, you know, we slowly, as a society, are maturing.
Yeah.
But no, I mean...
But, okay, so if we go from, like, celebrating Jim Morrison and Janis Joplin and even Kurt Cobain, or, you know, it's kind of a different thing. But to now, it's like Miley Cyrus, and oh my God, is she on Molly? And look at how...
Miley Cyrus is on Molly?
Don't you read the internet?
Are they saying that she's doing Molly? She's doing...
Okay, I am not here to educate you about pop culture. She has a song that she says we're doing Molly, you know, but then...
Oh, does she reference Molly? That's adorable. I hope Billy Ray loves her. I hope she finally gets the love of her dad.
You know what? I think she's fine. I think she's fine and, like, an excellent marketer.
It's hack marketing, too, because it's not like she's even sowing new ground.
Right.
It's just a cynical packaging of young female sexuality that had, and she's like the fifth, you know, how many pop stars, they've been since pop music began.
Right.
You know, so it's not like it's even a real.
But I will say that I do think that does influence teenagers, but like her saying, oh, we're doing Molly at a party and then like rubbing the foam finger is not good. It's I think other people like are, like Lady Gaga, I just talked about this on a television show, so I have some sound bites for
you. No, please, I love it.
But no, Lady Gaga went on Watch What Happens and talked about, he said, what about you and Molly? And she said, basically, oh, I can't remember how many times I've done it. Kids don't do it, you might end up like me, which is like the greatest endorsement the drug Molly has ever had.
But, okay, you know, and I know, I'm going to say, you have men, and possibly David, men...
Yeah.
Who love Jack Kerouac. Because, yes.
Yeah.
Right. At one point. Because every writer, every male writer, to a certain degree, at one point, romanticized Jack Kerouac. Kerouac, a terrible writer. Just unreadable.
Yeah.
Just terrible.
Is Bukowski bad, too?
Bukowski, Bukowski is not entirely his hard-drinking stereotype. He can write some crushingly beautiful poetry that has nothing to do with getting wrecked.
Mm-hmm.
But a lot of young men, creative men,
mm-hmm.
you romanticize these kinds of heroes,
mm-hmm.
The Hemingways, mm-hmm. the writers who were hard-drinking. And,
mm-hmm.
and you know, and as I look at, if you look at them objectively, these were all unhappy men.
Mm-hmm.
Who probably could have written better if they weren't managing their manifold mental illnesses with drugs and alcohol.
Yeah.
But when you're 15, you know, drugs and alcohol, these are powerful symbols of independence.
Yeah,
they're powerful individuality lubricants. People who You know, like, and if you're 15 and if you're 20 and you have so many anxieties and social fears,
right.
that booze, man, can make you feel and act like the rock star you're too afraid to be.
Oh, interesting.
And, you know, because that's why, you know, I was, I know it's hard to believe, but I was kind of a roly-poly nerd when I went into college. I know. And look at the baller sitting on your couch now.
I'm serious.
I did not have a lot of macho currency when I went to college. What I could do, though, was quaff an amazing amount of beer
right.
and tell jokes
right.
and rib and insult and make fun
right.
of, you know, for whatever reason. I went to an art school that was part of a university.
Where did you go?
I went to a school called Virginia Commonwealth University,
okay.
and it has a very large state school.
Uh-huh.
Great. Use of money,
uh-huh.
state money.
Uh-huh.
But for whatever reason, I was parked in a frat dorm where a uh-huh. lot of frat guys were.
Uh-huh.
Which is one reason I make fun of them, but I also have a soft spot because I kind of saw the... You know, frats get a lot of... Frats are terrible, oftentimes rapey institutions. But, you know, freshmen, all freshmen are scared little kids.
Right, right.
You know, it's pick your... Whatever you're afraid of. So I had sympathies for them. But I could mm-hmm. drink and I could, you know.
And they liked you, these
people. Sure, yeah. Because I could hold my, you know, that term, hold your liquor.
Yeah.
I wasn't a football star.
Right.
I didn't have that physical genetic gift.
But you had
or discipline.
Your wit.
I had the wit, but only under the, medication,
mm-hmm.
Which was the liquor, you know, my drink of choice, which was a Boilermaker, you know.
Without liquor, your wit was gone?
The courage.
Right.
But no, that's not even courage, though, because people say that, you know, what it is, because it's just shitty anxiety.
Yeah, lack of confidence, anxiety.
Right, right. But it's not, you know, people think, oh, you know, liquid courage. It's not, it doesn't give you courage. And it doesn't lower your inhibitions. It helps you manage your fear, because the fear is how much fear you have and how little fear you have is everyone's motivation for everything in life.
I 100% agree with that.
You know, so alcohol allowed me to pathetically manage my fears.
Right.
And in the 3 years plus that I had been sober, you know, the reason this has been a joyful and humbling experience for me was seeing how poorly I handled my fears,
mm-hmm.
and how right now in my life how I feel brave for the first time, because mm-hmm. I am tackling things that terrify me,
mm-hmm.
Without any net.
Like driving.
Driving is I hate it. It's terrible. Every time I drive in LA, I'm like, this is the best we can do. This is the best human civilization can come up with, is tens of thousands of autonomously piloted death machines. Piloted, by the way, by some supremely thoughtless
yes.
and stupid people.
Yeah.
It's over 50,000 people a year die
right.
on the American highways. That's twice as many as die from gunshot wounds.
Right. Well,
I think my fear of driving is well-founded.
No, it's very rational, I'm sure, but you end up... I mean, here's the thing. This is my sense. My sense is that driving, this fear of driving, mm-hmm. your feelings about driving influence your life more than one's fears about driving. My feelings about it. Just because when you first moved here, I was terribly excited to hear this news. I felt that it was Los Angeles' great gain.
It's like when you pitched me a Maxim.
And it was different. You did respond. I would email you and say, John, I'm so glad you're here. Let's hang out. And you basically said, and I'm like, I want to bring you to this place and I want you to introduce these people. And you basically said, well, I live and work in the Valley and I don't have a car. But then you got a car, and then I think I was talking to Sarah about it, and she's like, no, he drives now. And
just not to see Anna Davis.
No, but I think that with driving. It's just all you New Yorkers. You just have to get used to it. It's like you have to break through to the other side.
You know, when I was 10, my sister was in a terrible accident where she was in a coma for 3 weeks.
Okay, okay.
And so when I hit 16, my parents and I just silently traumatized.
Oh.
Silently were just like, well, maybe you don't have to drive at 16. And I was like, and I was relieved. I went to an urban school in Richmond. Didn't really have to drive. Lived off campus. Could walk to campus. Moved to New York.
Yeah.
So by missing, and I know now why we teach children to drive at 16.
Why?
Because their relationship to mortality is not set. And so they don't comprehend
the enormity of the risk they're taking.
Right. And so they're able to learn in this bubble of enthusiasm, and it becomes second nature.
I see.
This became a full-on blown control freak phobia. I moved here.
Yeah.
I hired a driving instructor.
So cute.
A nice racist Iranian woman from Glendale who loved making terrible Asian jokes. Her way of telling me not to not to push the gas. Wait, no. What would you do? I was really heavy on the brake.
Right. She'd say, don't be Asian.
Well, no, what she would say, and so, you know, I would hit the brake, and we would, like, you know, and our heads would...
forward,
right.
Yeah.
And she would go, no. Don't make me act like a, quote, Chinaman. And then she would bow quickly to, you know, to kind of mimic
the... I was going to say, if she was making Asian driving jokes or references...
She was an excellent teacher. I was mortified. Because then she would drive around and she'd just be like, watch out for Asian drivers, watch out for Hispanic drivers. She would go off on racism. Terrible.
Maybe she was just trying to help. Maybe she saw this ball of fear that you have around it and was
right.
thinking that maybe those warnings would help.
Right.
By
turning me into... But I went and I faced my fears. I mean,
yeah.
I took a driving instructor.
Yeah.
I had my intern, my 21-year-old intern, drive me to get my...
Cute.
My learner's permit.
Yeah.
I failed my first driving test.
Uh-huh.
Passed my second,
uh-huh.
bought a used car.
And that used car has a mileage of, what, like a couple, like 100 miles you put on it? Or?
And let's talk about carbon footprints.
No,
and how some members of our society want the earth to okay.
By the way, I drive less than any human being alive except for you.
Except for me.
But, I mean,
then we should be allies in this.
We should be allies in this war against drivers. But, like, the thing is, you would oftentimes, I even saw you do this, get into cabs constantly in New York.
Yes.
Where you are also at great risk. I had a cab driver fall asleep while driving me.
Oh, sure, but that's a completely different matter. It's completely different. You know what? I remember a couple of times, because I was thinking on the way over here, I remember you leaving a party once.
That happened a lot.
And I was still drinking.
Yes.
But it was at a point where I also knew you were sober.
Yeah.
And I remember...
Thinking I was judging you?
No. No. You looked so bored.
Oh, God.
And
this
just so annoyed. I would later understand why.
Well, no. Maybe I can explain why.
No, because I've been to plenty of parties sober now where I'm just
No! Okay, this is misrepresentative. I will tell you something about me in New York. I fucking hated it so much that you would never know because I was trying so hard to like it. I hated almost every minute that I was
that
there.
That just boggles my mind.
Yeah.
I don't know what your problem is.
I mean... It was, you're being facetious.
I'm not being facetious at all.
I was bored all the time. I just never found my
your
friends.
People.
Yeah, ever.
That's fair.
And
I
have never had that problem anywhere else.
Right.
And it's a big city, so you wouldn't think you'd have that problem. And I was bored all the time. I go to parties sober constantly here. And I don't sit there bored. So that was representative of New York, not sobriety.
Oy vey.
I love that you were judging. You were like, oh, sober people are miserable.
I'm sorry,
like,
I just wanted to take back. Did I judge you? I made an observation.
What party? I do remember.
It was just with some random sort, one of those random,
yeah.
sloppy.
Yeah.
Because, you know, New York is
yeah.
the greatest drinking city in the world.
Yeah.
Or in the country at the very, I'm not drunk all over the world. My ability, I even had, I had my home bar in Queens where I lived with real people because I'm a man of the people.
Yeah.
I'm not an elitist like you.
No.
Or the rest of the media.
Right. I'm the media? Okay. Go on. You.
Writer, creative arts.
You.
It's an amazing drinking town.
Yeah.
You can always get home.
Yeah.
Bars open till 4.
Yeah.
And then half of those bars, if you're kind to the bartender, close their doors and stay open till.
Yeah. Fine. Yeah. That's good. I didn't know that. I mean, because I was always so bored and leaving parties.
No,
and just
I remember distinctly.
Giving my
I remember distinctly
the party.
You leaving and trying to get into a cab and we say goodbye, and you just looked like, you know.
Okay, first of all, whenever I saw you in New York, I will say that was like, there were a bunch of drunks around. It was always the drunkest of the drunks.
Right.
And so
So you could have just been annoyed with me.
Possibly it was a direct reflection of my feelings.
It might have been because I never answered your stupid pitches.
Probably. It sounds like I had a lot of reasons to resent you.
Why are we even doing this podcast?
I don't know. I'm rethinking.
I got grievances against you, too.
No, but this is what I will tell you. I always enjoyed you. I did think you were a drunk. I really did think you were a drunk, okay?
Yeah, sure, no, that's fair.
But I always enjoyed you, and there are plenty of other people, especially in that crowd, that I thought were drunks that I did not enjoy. It didn't, because, and I'm not trying to, like, you know, like, clear the air and, like,
what start now? What start now?
But you are so smart and so fun to talk to that even totally shit-faced, you were actually fun to talk to.
That was a very drunk group of people. And you know what? And going back to that whole, you know, the thing between the drunk and the alcohol.
Yeah.
The alcoholic.
Yeah.
You know, it's... And I don't even know... I go so far as to say that's... Well, no. I won't say it's a gender thing.
Because a lot of those drunks were women.
But, I mean, hold on.
Why do you think you get to leave? Oh, okay.
I just don't know. I know in male, stereotypical, in groups of men that are ruled by gender norms,
mm-hmm.
I get the... why men who can drink and shoot shit are valued.
Mm-hmm.
In stereotypical gender, like female circles, I don't know what the value is. Like you know, like if there's 4 women and one of them can really...
Yeah. No, I don't think we... I will just... My experience was I could never find women who drank like me and wanted to do drugs like me. Until I moved to LA, and it was
great,
it was terribly exciting to find, and I mean, I found...
You're party people.
Yeah, and it was, and it was all free, it seemed to be free, because I was working in the media then, you know, and I think that was really dangerous and really excellent, because I do think that, like, this is an amazing city to bottom out in.
You know, it's funny you say that, because I've, because on one hand, I look around and I'm like, I don't know how I would have been a drunk in this city.
Because of the driving. We just drove drunk. It was awful.
Right. Well, that's what I've come to realize.
Yeah, yeah.
Is that
another feed into your car.
Right. I call it like between like, because it's also an early city.
Yeah.
But there are nightmare hours where stupid people are drunk.
Well, right,
but also, the one thing I find about Los Angeles is that, it's weird why it's a, you know, there's a... I was talking with friends about the romanticism of L.A.
Mm-hmm.
Like I romanticized New York as an artist, as a playwright,
mm-hmm.
as, you know... my New York is much different from the kind of hedge fund bro
mm-hmm.
high-rises in Williamsburg sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
But L.A., you know... there's a great... why can't I think of the architect...
I'm not going to be any help here. This is a New York architect.
He's like the most famous architect in the...
John Lautner? Is that an architect?
No, more famous.
Okay. I'm sorry. I know the more obscure ones. Rem Koolhaas, is that an architect? Don't do this to me.
Oh, see, now I need to know this.
No, you don't. I'm just going to tell you something. You don't. Anyway, finish your sentence.
He designed the Guggenheim.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, him. It doesn't matter. Go on.
Well, now I can't say the quote unless I...
Oh, how about skip the story and let's go back to you?
Do you edit this at all?
No.
No, you don't even remotely... was just wondering. I was like, you don't edit, do
no.
you?
No.
No, so any like, so me getting up to get coffee.
Yeah, everyone's going to know that you just got up without explanation.
Well, then your listeners can. I'm going to hate this, but there's a, it's a yeah. quote that that if you turn the world on its side, everything
all
loose.
All the loose pieces fall
yeah,
to L.A.
Right.
A famous architect said that?
Yes.
I go around saying that, and I've never...
It's a misfit city. It's an escape city. It's
no, just, but that's not and, what it means.
And it's the story. It is.
No, I'll tell you.
Absolutely, it's
the
what
quote
it means.
Means
don't you tell me what that.
The people who are unstable end up here.
The misfits.
Oh, okay. Yeah. I wouldn't say misfits and unstable necessarily always go together. I wouldn't.
I would absolutely say that.
Okay. Well, then we define misfits differently. Maybe you can get off your phone. Nobody cares what
I, you know, this. I, Frank Lloyd Wright.
Oh, him.
The famous. Who are, let me loop back for a second.
Rem Koolhaas.
Who are those other two that you were brought up? I was like, oh yeah, no, not those two. Famous for, I don't know what
they're
the fuck.
They're famous for architecture.
They're not Frank Lloyd Wright. None of them are in a Simon and Garfunkel song.
No, as far
that's
as
famous.
We know.
That's famous.
Yeah.
He's like the most famous.
You know,
he's like the Beatles of American architects.
Okay, fine. Fine. You're right. I'm very tired, but it's good that you're keeping me on my toes / shaming me.
How late were you up last night?
It's not that I was up late. I was up sort of late for me, but I had my show last night, and every single time, maybe this has to do with like alcoholism and addiction or something, I get my adrenaline gets going.
Uh-huh.
And so after the show, I it's going, and then I fall asleep. And I always wake up super early the next morning with this sort of like lightness in my step. And I say, oh, that's just so weird. I was up late. I slept very little, and I just feel so excellent. And then at about 2 o'clock the next day, the fatigue of like 10,000 lives lived sets in. And that's what happened. And I do
well,
think...
Don't. We got another 2 hours to go on this unedited podcast.
But here's my point.
Oh,
this is the point I wanted to make.
Uh-huh.
And it reminds me of cocaine, because while I think you were just more a straight-up liquor person...
Oh, I had my cocaine phase.
So I would find when I did cocaine, I would stay up all night doing it. I would take Ambien, and I would wake up, and I would feel this lightness in my step, and I wouldn't feel depressed, and I would feel very well-rested. And I was just like, what's the problem with doing cocaine? And then the next day, it would be the day after, suicidal thoughts would set in. It was so weird. It skipped a day on me. Maybe it lasted. Maybe the shelf life was longer in my system.
The coke hangover.
It's depression.
It's yeah, no, it's an emotional nosedive. It's
yeah.
not. I found. I mean, the, yeah. you know, for me, the alcohol hangover was a very physical thing.
Yeah.
But that cocaine, the coke hangover, which is the beginning of withdrawals, you know,
yeah.
that's the thing,
yeah.
you know, would just send you into a twilight zone of self-loathing. It
yeah.
was just, you know, and,
yeah.
And then the only way, of course, eventually to not self-loathe and to feel normal is to do some more.
Tell me about your cocaine phase.
Well, there's one other question since,
yeah. Is this about Frank Lloyd Wright?
So, no.
Okay.
And also, it is a city. The whole story of the West are all the weirdos from the East Coast coming across the country to reinvent themselves. This is a city of con men and creative people.
Okay.
But that's the story of the, that's the story of the West.
The weirdos is the part I resent. Not the con
men
part.
Not the, what's the matter with being a weirdo?
It's more being like crazy and unstable. That's who is drawn
here. That's weird. You know the people who are thrown out of the village?
I think that's more common, actually.
What?
Being crazy and unstable.
No, what's
one in four
what's
is mentally
ill. What's uncommon is accepting it.
Yeah, yeah.
Because the paradigm doesn't want
yeah.
broken toys.
Right.
The toy chain, you know, we are all the, it's the nation of misfit toys. But, you know.
Yes.
LA is that's the whole point of the lint trap.
The what?
The lint trap metaphor.
Okay.
It's like, it's all the weird stuff. All
yeah.
the.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Right. The flakes and the con man and the people running from something. And also, more beautifully, the people who.
Have a dream.
Have a dream or want to change.
Yeah. I mean, that's why I love Los Angeles so much. And
that's the only romantic dimension that I like about, other than the fact too, that LA has a wildness about it. that is different from any city that I've lived in.
What do you mean?
You know, that so much natural splendor nips at the heels of the entire sort of basin. Mm. You go an hour in any direction and there's some dramatic nothing.
Yeah.
You know, wilderness. But it's still kind of a wild, there's a wildness to it, you know, that I find alluring. I find romantic.
Can we go back to your, are you done with your LA thoughts? Can we go back
Yes, I'm just defending New York because you, yes, we can go back to, we can talk all about Coke all you want.
No, it is true that I put New York lovers on the defensive because I attack that city. A city I love visiting. I love visiting it so much.
I love visiting Los Angeles.
Well,
I also live in the beautiful
Toluca Lake.
San Fernando Valley.
Where everybody moves eventually, so, you know, ahead of your time. So my impression, yes, was that you enjoyed the liquor, mm-hmm. and I certainly did not ever expect you to be a sober person. That blew my mind when I heard that. And I'm trying to remember how I heard that.
I probably approached you.
You must have.
I did. I think it was The Fix.
Yes, you emailed me out
but
of
you
the blue.
You were also, you know, there were a handful of people in my life, including two very old friends from college, from my art school, who had done some amazingly violent partying with me. Just crazy fucking shit. Mm-hmm. Just, you know, who, one is 11 years sober and the other is 14. The other, you know, she was only sober because her arm was probably going to fall off from gangrene.
Right, from shooting him,
yeah,
right?
Yeah. So there are a handful of people who are, because for me, the path to sobriety was a gradual thing. I don't have, which is one reason like AA was difficult for me at first. I don't have that crazy inciting incident, that wrapping a tree around, a car around a tree, or, you know, I don't have that story, you know. What I have was a girlfriend at the time who I loved very much. We had a terrible fight while I was drunk, which I had terrible verbal fights.
It's not the girlfriend that you're with now.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, okay. But and then we had broken up and we got back together. It was someone, I got sober because someone I loved looked at me and said, for the first time,
right,
I think you're an alcoholic.
Right.
You know, and that was just this earth-shattering sort of thing to have somebody who cares about you look you in the eyes and tell you that. Because it's not something you can necessarily tell somebody. I don't know.
Right.
You know, you can't tell someone that. And in her fury and in her heartbreak at my anger the night before, she just was like, she just called me an alcoholic.
Right.
And that was just this terrible moment and therapy and stuff. But it wouldn't have worked for me if I had not had, over the course of a couple of years, met people who blew up the stereotype of sobriety.
Like Anna David, who's bored at every party?
Anna David, who was a lovely, talented, successful, charismatic...
Nice. I'm liking this better.
Hard-working professional who was able to effortlessly exist in this party world I was at. And flit about and fly to LA and be in New York and be here and sort of like there were people who I knew, and it was also people who I knew. It was an essay that Roger Ebert wrote, but it was me, you know. It was slowly seeing that, you know, because the truth is we want to talk about the drunk alcoholic dichotomy. The idea too that there's one kind of alcoholic is a misnomer, you know. Like a lot of people, I think, who have drinking problems, who have you know, underlying issues that they medicate alcohol with. When you're an alcoholic, they're like, well, I'm not some broken guy, an SRO who broke up with, you know. Like,
right.
You know?
Well, there's dual diet. I mean, it's co-occurring disorders, basically. Mental right. illness coupled with alcoholism.
Right. And in many ways, you know, you're right. And there, it's coping. It's all kinds of sorts. Mm-hmm. But I'm just saying that the stereotype of the alcoholic mm-hmm. is so iconic after 80 years of this sort of thing that that to see... It took me having to see people...
Right.
Defy that.
Right, interesting. So, to you, the alcoholic or the sober person was what?
I would say, well, look, it was like my first meeting that I dragged myself to.
The meetings in New York are horrible, I'm just
going to
say.
No, no. It taught me how to find the right one.
Okay.
Because I would eventually find some in NYU, and near NYU, and in mm-hmm. Chelsea, mm-hmm. that were young. And I tell people, too, who come to me, I was like, look, these meetings, it's like a therapist. And I'm also... You know, I attribute my sobriety to excellent therapy as well.
Right.
You
right.
know, I had an amazing therapist who
right.
who was also able to help me through my AA prejudices.
Right, right.
You know, of which there were many, and I still have many. But the fact is, I can never drink again because I will be unhappy.
Right. Did that therapist ever tell you that she thought or he thought you needed to stop drinking? Or
no, he. Gently led me into that because mm-hmm. this sort of thing, it was ideal for me because I came to a point where I was like, I cannot
right.
drink anymore. A, and B, not drinking would be the best thing that I could do.
Right.
Because the point that I'm making is, you know, meeting, knowing that you were sober in public about it
mm-hmm.
and knowing other people who were sober in public about it
mm-hmm.
Allowed me... dared my imagination
right.
to think of sobriety as not this depressing
right. the end of
daily
life. Yeah.
struggle.
Right.
This dreary, bleak
right.
sort of... My first meeting was literally like it was in Midtown and it was a windowless room
right.
in the back of wherever. And again, because I didn't see myself, you know, but the truth is I saw myself, even if,
right.
even if I did, you know, even if, you know, I just didn't connect with those,
you did very depressing
that.
People sharing very depressing
yeah,
things.
Yeah, that's pejorative, you know, because again, the truth is, I was new to it. There was a wide variety of people there and I think maybe I didn't like seeing myself because
right,
they were alcoholics just
right,
like, just
right.
like I was.
That's interesting. I mean, yeah. that I think is the problem with quote unquote meetings I hate is that I don't want to see myself in those people.
Yeah, no, that's absolutely true. But I mean, I also think though it was an older
yes,
group.
Yes, okay.
You know.
Yeah.
So, it was an older group and it was a group that I stumbled, it was an open meeting, but
yeah.
I stumbled in and it was a group that had a rapport. And so I also probably felt
like left out.
Odd man out.
Yeah.
But like a therapist, because I think a lot of people get a therapist, you know, especially people who roll their eyes.
Right.
And but they get a therapist and it's a bad therapist.
Yes.
And they think you have to stick with that therapist.
Yes.
And I tell them it's be slutty. Like if your therapist, embrace them.
Yeah.
If you want to seek help, if you don't connect, if there's
yeah.
no rapport or trust,
right.
it's nothing personal. Get another recommendation from somebody.
Yeah.
Try it another therapist.
Yeah.
Because that trust, not that it's a true relationship. It's a transactional. It's a
yeah.
He's a mental health
yeah.
Professional. It's a transaction.
Right.
And they're not your friend. They're not your
right.
your father or your whatever. But there should be some kind of a rapport.
And I would say even further because I had a therapist in New York. I mean everything went awry in New York. No wonder
okay.
I was bored. But I had a therapist.
You look. Bored with the party. Because, you know what, maybe the party
was
boring.
I'm sure it was.
I'm sure your pitches weren't boring.
You had to remind me that our relationship started with you rejecting me. But my therapist in New York, we had a rapport and I trusted him, but I only saw once I got into therapy back in LA with the right therapist that I found him incredibly depressing. So it's also, I think therapy is so influenced by the way that person looks at life. And this was like a depressed Jew. Jewish therapists are great. We love them. It's a Jewish holiday. I'm just saying that man in particular, I didn't realize that he, it made me feel worse to be around him every week.
Well, I mean, it's also a very, you know, human profession.
Yeah.
And, you know, and that's why I think that having that kind of chemistry.
Yeah.
You know, to just a little bit is important, and I think that works with meetings too.
Right.
And I'm by no means an AA pusher.
Yeah.
And I could talk at length about it, but at the same time, people who I know and love very much, you know, I had a very religious upbringing.
Mm.
I'm a Catholic. My granddad was a Baptist preacher.
Oh, wow.
My mom was a Mexican Catholic, and so I had a lot of...
I always forget there's Mexican.
Yes, I am half Mexican. So that's another thing, too. Maybe this is more my city than yours. Because that's another thing I discovered about Los Angeles, is people think it's a soulless city. But the soul of LA, the real soul, the kernel of it, is a Mexican city. It's got a Spanish soul.
Oh, I don't think LA is a soulless city.
No,
so.
but the stereotype is,
yeah.
You know, the entertainment industry,
yeah.
And the fat, you know, the sort of,
yeah.
You know, there's an actual city of real people here, but the
right.
The soul of it is,
right.
Is Spanish.
So you're the soul of LA, or half of the
That's
soul.
What I'm saying,
yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, I had a very religious upbringing.
Yeah.
So when I was confronted with that AA notion of...
Yeah, higher power.
Surrender, not just the high, because I'm also, like, pretty much, you know, an atheist,
mm-hmm.
Who does not... But at the same time, my parents, I have very fond memories of the way my parents raised me in religion,
mm-hmm.
And it reminds me of my folks,
mm-hmm.
And that notion that you are powerless,
mm-hmm.
That there are things beyond your control,
mm-hmm.
You know, that, you know, as they, that Baptists love to say, you know, thy will be done,
mm-hmm.
You know, that it is someone else's, you know, the God's will.
Mm-hmm.
It's done, not yours.
Yeah.
That notion that you are powerless before the cosmos was not a revelation to me.
Right.
It was kind of a reaffirmation.
Right.
So the fact that I there's this, you know, that I can't drink,
mm-hmm.
that I'm kind of like, you know, that I could have a beer today and probably keep it together, but, you know, tomorrow. Maybe a week later, maybe a month later, my life's gonna go to shit.
Right.
I'm gonna be a very unhappy person.
But your life was quote unquote working on some levels when you.
Oh, I was totally functional. I was totally functional. Not totally. I was kind of functional.
You were,
You know, there were. You know, there were instances where I would have employers be like, whoa.
Oh, really?
Oh, okay. Sure. But at the same time, though, it's not like I was a banker.
Right.
Or a heart surgeon.
Right.
You know, partly I'm like, you know, partly I was like, well, this is what you want.
Right, right.
You know, you want a boozy guy who, you know, this is what you want, right? And then I would take my work home with me. You know, the radio was a golden age for my drinking because I would, you know, I was so not ready to perform and I would finish that night show at 11 and I would go to a bar, my local bar,
mm-hmm.
And if I had a good show, man, let's celebrate.
Right.
And if I would have a bad show,
let's drown sorrow.
Shit. You know, and so I just got stuck in this endless, you know, and also anxiety.
Yeah.
Anxiety, fear.
So,
you know.
So when you, you know, when your girlfriend said this to you and you went to therapy and you went to the meeting, how quickly did you then embrace sobriety?
Oh, almost immediately.
Okay.
My last drink was that night that I got into a fight. That,
wow.
That, and it wasn't, you know, it was just I was bitchy. It was a
yeah.
Bitchy fight. It was
yeah.
Just. You know, the way that, you know, that women excuse, you know, guys that have had a couple and the guy's a jerk and they have a fight.
Right, right, right.
You know.
So you're saying it wasn't that bad. It was just that it was
no, that's
so
what I'm saying.
Consistently.
You know, it was just his moment. She was just like,
right.
You have, you know, because she could see it.
And do you have drinking, is alcoholism in your family?
Not that I know of.
Yeah.
You know, it has to be.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, I've not drilled into that as much as
And so did you find it difficult? Did you have to stop going to those parties?
Anyone who quits drinking has to reevaluate their social strategy.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly for a while. I played a lot of video games. I did a lot of walking.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, I had a lot of sitting on the bed and staring into the void. But, you know, you had to do some pruning. You don't want to be that person.
Right, right.
You know?
You mean the one that says, I can't talk to you because I'm now so...
I can't go to the party, or I'm going to sit in the corner. You know,
right.
Like, I had a lot of support. I had a lot of friends that were supportive.
Yeah.
And I don't know what's worse, the people knowing that you're sober, and... I had a lot of friends, and they were all super attentive to buying me Diet Cokes.
Right, right.
You know, so... But eventually I learned, too, that those parties were boring.
Yeah, they are.
Yeah.
Not always. Not always.
No, but it just, you know, and that's fine. Because I, you know, because at the, you know, I went to so many of them and I contributed to it.
Yeah.
It's boring for me.
Yeah.
Not for them. And that's fine. Because a lot of my friends now that go out drinking, they're going out and drinking.
Yeah.
They're having fun.
Yeah.
This is once a month. It's whatever. It's healthy. They're drinking. They're not drunks. They're not alcoholics.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I'm there. Or I'll show up for an hour.
Yeah.
And then, you know, and then just leave. Because it's fine.
And you didn't have, like, detox. Okay.
No. It was a crystallizing... And that's what I'm saying, though. I think a lot of people... Like, if you had asked me if I'm an alcoholic, I would have been like... You know, I'm like, well, here's the thing. I was what we used to joke in my neighborhood as, I guess they call it an Irish alcoholic.
Mm.
But I would never drink at home.
Okay.
I never had any alcohol at home.
Interesting.
Not a drop.
Right.
You know, the Irish alcoholic is A, redundant, and B, what do they call it? I forget it. Frank Lloyd Wright. I would drink at the bar, which was not, it was affordable because it was the borough, and I would just drink,
$3
Boilermakers, and I would drink up until I got home. And if I didn't have alcohol at home, not a drop.
Right.
How could I be an alcoholic?
Right.
How could I be an alcoholic?
Yeah.
I have a job.
Yeah.
How could I be an alcoholic?
So before this,
I am a handsome, charming, you know, drunk. You know. But.
So you had, before this crystallizing conversation, that thought, those thoughts had been plaguing you.
Absolutely. Yeah. Well, not plaguing. I would have moments where I could see the possibility.
Mm-hmm.
Of another way of living my life.
Mm-hmm. Were you drinking every night?
Oh yeah. Oh sure. Absolutely.
And like.
But you know, like it's that negotiation that a lot of us have. It's like, well, if I can not drink on the Lord's Day,
right?
That is a sign
that everything's cool.
That I have superhuman self control.
Yeah.
It's never. Well, if I'll only drink once a week. It's always, well, if I could not drink on Sunday, one day, that's me showing you.
Proving. So, and you would have 6-7 cocktails. Well, I mean, do you know?
Oh, yeah, sure. The baseline was 3 bourbons with beer chasers and maybe 1 buyback.
Mm-hmm.
And that was normal.
Mm-hmm.
That was just like, how could I be an alcoholic?
Has 6.
Yeah, well, I would have 5.
Yeah.
Looking back, that's a phenomenal amount of alcohol to have in an hour every, you know.
Yeah.
I would just, blah, blah. But that was my baseline. I mean, I had quit smoking weed
mm-hmm.
when I was 30.
Mm.
And then, you know, and I sobered up when I was, I'm 39 now,
mm-hmm.
so 37,
mm-hmm.
36, can't do math,
mm-mm.
Leave me alone, Frank Lloyd Wright.
Yeah, so you had you smoked a lot of pot before then?
Oh, yeah, huge stoner.
Okay.
But I had quit it pretty effortlessly, as I think a lot of people, you know.
Right, well, when there's alcohol around, it can be very effortless.
I didn't like the hangover. The pot hangover made me stupid, and I could not be stupid at work.
Pot didn't make you stupid, just the hangover did?
But when I was high, that's fine. But the morning after, right. when I had to go to work, the
right.
hangover
right. I gotcha.
Like made me
interesting.
Like dull.
Yeah.
Not sharp.
Yeah.
And that affected my livelihood.
Well, okay, and so then when you were, say, 2 years sober, you made the move from New York to LA mm-hmm. and had to find a new support system. Ish?
Well, no, I have friends out here who have been, who are sober.
Yeah.
And who supported me. I'll tell you, I found it easier to be
It is. Much
sober
easier.
Here.
Oh, God.
Partly
God.
Cultural.
Yeah.
Culturally. Partly just a different everything, you know. But a lot of my friends out here are either, if not wholly and completely 100% supportive of the sober lifestyle, they themselves
yeah.
are also sober.
Okay. And for work, I mean, we could talk a little bit about that. I mean,
are we done? Is that,
we're not
well,
done.
Let's recap.
We're never done.
We're going to recap.
We're definitely going to recap. Well, first of all, I feel like we should talk about Red Eye maybe a little bit.
Red Eye was a lot of fun.
You know that I was on it a lot too.
We were on it together.
No, like, I was just wondering that. I don't think so. Maybe once.
We were on it like twice.
You look so offended.
I'm totally offended.
Well, I do know that it was a challenge to be on with you because you are so sparkling
so
and witty. And I was always so self-conscious and you're so
you did that
political.
With a, and you know what? You couldn't even do that with a straight face.
I'm serious.
You couldn't even do that with a straight face. You don't edit this.
I don't.
Right. She was grinning. Just grinning like Lady Satan while she was, quote, flattering me.
No,
unquote.
I mean this. I mean this because I am always... Okay, am I grinning now?
Yeah, grinning. Right.
I am always self-conscious doing Red Eye, and you are so intelligent and informed about politics and
I have a soft spot for Greg and Andy and Bill.
Yeah.
I have done a lot of political parody.
Yeah.
I am a pinko communist. Mm-hmm. Fox News is a complicated organization with a political bent I don't agree with.
Mm-hmm.
But those gentlemen, you know, some people return your calls when you're laid off and some people don't.
Yeah.
And they return my calls and I am... and will forever be grateful and very proud to be part of a supremely bizarre show on at 3 in the morning. Because say what you will about Fox, and say what you will about Red Eye. I mean, it's been on for 6 years. It has had its different eras and different missions. But I'm still very proud to have been part. I mean, I sat next to John Bolton and, you know, a guy who... I deeply politically disagree with Ann Coulter.
Mm.
I've sat next to her a couple
mm-hmm,
of times,
me too.
And I have powerful opinions about her.
Mm-hmm.
But I, you know, it was we were at a table. There was a bonhomie,
mm-hmm.
you know, and you know, I could virulently disagree, but it was very 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 cordial, almost friendly,
yeah.
I like that because friends of mine are always like, well, how did you Dana Perino? How did you do it? And I'm just like, well, you know, just did. I could not disagree with her more. I, you know, Greg.
Yeah.
Writes some things that I'm just like, I you know, I put my glass down on my nose and I
right.
cluck. It's like Greg.
Right.
But that's okay. You know.
And so you.
We were on like the show like twice.
I think once. I think possibly it was so scarring to be so you know not
shit.
Able to
so
shine
full of shit.
Because of you
are
taking
full...
the limelight naturally and effortlessly as is your way. And
terrible.
Who
person.
Else were we on with then? Tell me that.
Well,
you remember
great,
it so well
in the great tradition of Anna David. You were so effervescent.
It's blind. You blinded me.
It blocked out who else could have been.
Yeah.
On that show, probably some dude from Wall Street.
Maybe
they love them some fucking.
Maybe it was Aaron Coulter. That's possible. Well, so okay, and so you you moved out to LA. You now run this website. Do we talk about that? Do we not want to talk about it? I don't care.
Well, I don't know why you would ask because we don't edit this.
Okay, so we're not going to talk about it. But we are going to talk about it.
I know. I moved out here for a job, and it's a great job.
Yeah.
Free of any of the angst of my of went on in a new. It's gone. I'm quite. Happy in regards to the sobriety.
Yeah.
You know, it is without any, it's a completely 100% positive thing. And it is probably one of the absolute best things I have ever done.
Right.
You know,
because that lack of angst, don't you think that is a large part of it?
Because I have found ways to manage the insecurities and anxieties that plague us all,
mm-hmm.
instead of painting over them,
mm-hmm.
or anesthetizing myself,
mm-hmm.
from them.
Mm-hmm.
Because the truth is, I was, unhappy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because like pickling yourself. Drinking away your problems is this weird kind of like a time travel. It's just weird because you know that when you sober up, shit comes back.
Yeah.
Chickens come home to roost, and emotions flood back in, and the thing about drinking too much is it allows you to not take responsibility for your actions.
Right. And for a lot of things.
But specifically that responsibility for your actions.
Right.
You know, like, here's the thing. Like, when I was drinking, I was notoriously bad about paying my bills.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'd pay them late.
Mm-hmm.
As a freelancer, I would not pay my taxes.
Oh, yeah.
And that shit would come back to haunt you.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And that's like low-level junkie behavior. That's
right.
That's being like, oh, bills. You know what? I'm going to drink. I'm going to put this down
right.
on the newsstand,
right.
and I'm going to forget about it,
right.
and I'm not going to take responsibility for that. And then,
right.
and then when my electricity gets turned off,
would that happen?
Oh, sure. And then I,
immediately.
I'd be like, I'm so sorry, but like that's like that kind of bullshit.
Yeah,
that's,
yeah.
So it is 100% positive to be able to take full responsibility,
right.
for my actions.
Mm-hmm.
Because the worst feeling, I think, is being in that alcoholic haze and having to eventually take responsibility for, decisions you failed to make.
Right.
You know, like, so it's 100% positive. And it's very empowering to feel that I'm as fully responsible as I've ever been.
How do you handle that, or how did you handle, or how do you continue to handle the onslaught of emotions that had been bottled up and that you weren't used
dancing.
To?
Dancing.
Oh,
you don't like that answer.
Do you? I mean, you are a humorist.
You mean...
Why did that get the eye roll? No, okay.
Through art? Through the expression?
Okay, fine. I just don't believe you.
What?
About dancing.
Okay, well, not publicly. Therapy.
Yeah, so you found a new one out here?
Oh, sure, yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Walking.
Mm-hmm.
You know, is a scientifically proven form of anxiety maintenance.
Maintenance or sort of anxiety reducing.
Sure, but okay. But maintaining, because there've been multiple studies about, there've been examples of it throughout history too, where people have talked about the psychological benefits of movement.
Right, but not so you don't take it far enough to go like. you know, to a gym or like run. It's just new people.
Well, no, working out has that benefit as well.
Yeah.
But walking.
Okay.
Is just the very, and it's a very simple sort of thing, because it's not even working out though.
Yeah.
You know, just the movement of it and going through the meditative qualities of that very basic sort of form of exercise is a...
And do you can think about doing program more?
The program?
Yeah, as they say.
I feel... AA is a remarkable piece of American genius in a way,
mm-hmm.
you know, that those two gentlemen, you know, people have to understand how primitive psychology was and how epidemic a problem alcohol was.
Well, and that psychology had failed to make
any completely
impact.
Failed.
Yeah.
That's what I mean. Primitive in the most, and it remained primitive for decades too. That they were able to invent this out of almost whole cloth, without even really any research other than their own,
right?
You know, experiences. These fail safes, these series of fail safes and systems to keep people from not drinking.
Mm-hmm.
Because for an alcoholic, for an AA, it's a zero-sum game.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you are sober or you're not. There's no...
Right.
And that they came up with a series of fail-safes that weren't entirely scientific.
Right.
That were partly wisdom, partly religion.
Arguably not scientific at all.
Sure, right. Except in the very kind of basic, like, anecdotal, evidential, you know, like here's my, you know, experiences having drinking all this sort of time.
Right.
You know, because that's the thing, too, you know, but, you know, AA is very much like church. There's a homily. There's choruses. You know, people talk in unison. It's very much like church.
What's homilies?
The pastor speaks
Oh, so you're saying the people sharing, like the speaker is sort of like the pastor.
Sure. I mean, well, it's a group event.
Right.
It's a you know, there's that aspect of theater that, you know,
there's a very little unison speak. I mean, there's like
no, but there is a scripture and there are various rituals in that hour that everyone knows.
Yes.
Right. And this is not in the negative sense whatever.
Right.
These kinds of group rituals have been part of humanity for forever.
Right.
And there's a reason why we find comfort in them.
Right.
But it's a remarkable program and incredibly complicated. And I think maybe it kind of chafes here and there because, you know, psychology and society is changing,
mm-hmm.
and it's, you know, how it looks at, you know, like I respect people that need to remain anonymous.
Yeah.
I early on made the decision to speak about it publicly,
mm-hmm.
For a multitude of reasons. Number one, I'm proud of it.
Yeah.
Number two, it was a check for me because also I want all my friends to know it, because
mm-hmm.
I wanted it to be easy for friends of mine who are uncomfortable with it.
Yes.
To fade away and have happy
interesting.
Lives.
Right, right, right.
If you know...
Yeah.
I don't drink.
Yeah.
And it's all cool.
Yeah.
And you don't invite me to your party.
Yeah. Did anybody say anything to you that was weird?
Never.
Yeah.
I had one in the early days when I was really shaky. I had one, the wife of a friend get drunk and not like that I wasn't party boy.
Yeah.
In fact, you know, and the thing too, when you tell somebody that you're an alcoholic, they react the same way you tell somebody that you had a death in the family.
They do.
You know, when my dad died, I would always get the, you know, I'm sorry, what did he die of?
Right.
And I'm like, you know, lung cancer. Was he a smoker?
Right.
It's like, Well, yeah, he was. And it's pure human nature. Right. But what you're thinking is, am I going to get it?
Yeah.
Could I get it?
Totally.
Oh, he's a smoker and he's old.
Yeah.
I'm not a smoker. I'm not old.
Yeah.
Okay. So, you know, when I would tell people I'm an alcoholic,
right.
You know, really what their first response is I'm not.
Yeah.
You know,
I am. I mean, that's who's uncomfortable with it.
Oh, I have, but no, whether they are or are not.
Yeah.
The reaction I found too
is they're not thinking about you; they're thinking about that.
Right. And again, it's a very human, self-interested, fear sort of like reaction, and it's a very awkward sort of thing. Because I told a number of close friends, and all of my close friends that I told, even those that were a little floored by it,
mm-hmm.
even those who I had partied with, across the board, they were supportive, and you know. But there were people who, you know, that reaction. Do you think I am? It's like, well, I'm not.
Right, because I think that people who drink a lot confuse sober people with cops sometimes, and they think that sober people are going around and being like, making a note of that,
right.
and that we're judging when, like, really, we're probably thinking about ourselves.
I've had people reach out to me, of course, as you have, you know. Mm-hmm. You know, am I an alcoholic? And I'm just like, I don't.
Yeah, I can't say.
I was like, I don't know.
Yeah.
A, B, would never be my place.
Yeah.
To tell you.
Yeah.
What you are or
yeah.
are not.
Yeah.
You know? And I accept, too, that there is, you know, it's one thing that I think a lot of alcoholics need to remember, too, is that, you know, the vast majority of people don't have drinking problems.
Yeah.
You know, the vast majority of people have a couple a week.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
You know, the vast amount of people might binge in their 20s and then grow out of it.
Yeah.
You know, so I also need to remind myself, too, that I'm not the norm.
Right.
You know, and that most of my friends, even those who will go out and get a little red nose, have a couple too much wine, they're being normal.
Right.
You know, and that helps me too. You know, they're being normal, and I will go to their party. But once they go to Funtown,
yeah,
which is 3 drinks,
yeah,
I'm not fun anymore.
Yeah,
and that's okay.
Yeah,
that is okay.
Yeah,
you know, I am fine with that.
Well, I think this has been delightful.
Are you sure you don't edit any of this?
Well, I mean, I kind of
like... Do you know how to edit?
Yes, of course. Why would you ask me?
All right.
You think Frank Lloyd Wright would ask me such a question? Now, I think that what's marvelous about podcasts is the humanity that you can hear.
Is that right?
Yes. I am serious. That, like, you don't... It's not all edited perfectly.
Uh-huh.
That's
all
what
right.
we like.
All right.
When I say we, I mean...
The podcast community of Los Angeles.
Yeah, they elected me spokesperson, which is really exciting.
A lot of fucking podcasts in this town.
Yeah.
Too many.
I don't disagree.
Right.
If people were interested in finding you, I know that they could go to johndevore.com.
Yeah, it's a boring little website. You can follow me on Twitter.
Yeah, that's not boring.
And
that is at John DeVore.
Yes, that is.
Yeah.
I'm very flattered.
I'm so glad.
I wrote an essay for you about The Fixed.
You did.
About the first person that I told I was an alcoholic.
Yeah, a chicken vendor.
Right. Like a food truck.
Yeah.
Late at night. The
guy
who I used to go and order food from when I was trashed. That was a big milestone for me.
Because that was coming out.
On a public sort of level. It was a piece of writing that I enjoyed. That was very good.
Yeah, it was very good,
myself.
Always, yeah.
But that was a big deal for me. And you made that a very easy process, you know. So thank you for that.
No, I mean, you're...
And it was a great, like, $50. So,
you got to retire off of that, which was great. You're such a talented writer. It was easy. I was thrilled that you wanted to do it.
I like The Fix. I like the...
It's gone. Did you know that?
I did.
Okay.
But I like the core idea.
Do you know that this podcast is a subsidiary of my site, which is even better?
Yes, of course.
Of course.
Yeah.
So...
Why don't you plug your site?
After Party Chat. Well, these people know.
Well, of course they know, but
of
I just want to see.
Of course they know. Yeah, no, the fix was what it was.
No, it's been done for a while, hasn't it?
Yeah.
I don't know. I wrote one essay.
Yeah.
Like, this is brilliant.
And I'm so glad that that was a good experience.
What that website did...
Yes.
...was it gave you a platform to evangelize your brand.
Oh, did it?
Of life-affirming, positive, sober living.
Possibly it did that. Possibly. It was definitely I learned a lot doing that.
Right.
And I am grateful.
Which is why I'm a fan of yours.
Yes.
I'm a fan.
Well, it's very mutual. So I'm gonna...
Can I have gum now?
You can have gum now. I'm gonna stop this. This was super fun.